Okay, we're talking about proteins. Talking about protein purification. That means separation of what your favorite protein away from all the other proteins. It's a matter of separation. I stress this word because in English it is ambiguous, separation. So some of you will get confused between two kinds of separation. Like there's some problems in which you say, is this a good method for purifying a protein, like hydrolysis, right? So hydrolysis destroys the protein. So it's antithetical to what you want to do. And yet you're separating. You're separating one part of the protein from another part, the amino acids. So they separate like all the blonde students on the left and all the brunettes on the right. That's what we're doing. There's also separate your head from your shoulders. We're not doing that. So the word, you have to take it in context. So we have protein separations, and we talked about ultracentrifugation as one way based on shape and size, size being molecular weight here. And then we talked about native gel electrophoresis, movement through a gauntlet of barriers presented by this plastic-like polymer in the gel, as well as the charge on the protein. So you got charge and size separating there. And now we're talking about a variation that's much more commonly used, a variation on electrophoresis, which separates only on the basis of size. So you might say, well, that's less useful. And in some sense, it is less useful for the purpose of purifying your protein. But it's a very powerful analytical tool for seeing what the molecular weight of your protein is, or at least of its subunits. So that's polyclimagel electrophoresis again, so that's PAGE, and it's SDS page. So SDS stands for sodium dodecyl sulfate, and that's a detergent that you find in commonly used. It's in most toothpaste, for example. And it's got a long chain, hydrocarbon chain, followed by a sulfuric acid, a sulfate group at the end, much like a phospholipid, except... much like a fatty acid, rather, except more powerful than fatty acid because that acid is sulfate is strong. So there it is in its full glory of its hydrophobic part, and then its very highly polar part. This should be two or more negatives over here. So what happens when you put a protein in the presence of this SDS is that the detergent denatures it, for one thing. Won't break any denaturants. Do not break covalent bonds. So if there's any disulfide bonds holding us together, it won't affect those. But it will otherwise destroy all the weak bonds that are holding the protein together, number one. And they do that. It does this mainly by, part of this is a little mysterious, but certainly it does bind all over the protein to the backbone, all over the place, regardless of the side chains. And it binds to the side chains too, but not so distinctively. As a result of this denaturation, or in the denaturing process, the way it does it is by binding, and so the protein chain becomes coated with these SDS molecules bound by hydrophobic forces mainly, and so because they carry the strong negative charge, the proteins become negatively charged as of this entity. So now if you subject this to electrophoresis, it's only going to go one way, and it's going to be acted upon by the electromotive force, to say the anode down here, the positive pole. They're going to run towards so you know which way they're going to run now, always towards the anode. And, not so obvious, the electromotive force on them that's pushing them, or pulling them, is proportional to the charge per unit length. So the heavier it is, the more negative charges you need in order to move it towards the anode. Now, since a short polypeptide and a long polypeptide, since they're uniformly coded to the first approximation, all these things I have to take with some grain of salt, but for the first approximation, they have the same charge per unit length, so they will be acting on with the same force. So the only thing that's going to separate them is their ability to get through the gel. So big guys are now random coils are going to have trouble getting through. They will get through eventually, find a way. The little short chains will go through much faster. So SDS, polyacrylamide gel electrophoresis, separates on the basis of molecular weight. Now, what if you had disulfide bonds in here? Then you're going to have a little bit of a compromise in this denaturation. It's not going to be like a random coil, but held together at a few places. So usually when you use this technique to get it completely denatured, so it will run according to its molecular weight, you also get rid of those disulfide bonds. I think I talked about this at least in one of the lectures. So you can treat with a reagent like mercaptoethanol, which has disulfide bonds itself, and exchanges in a higher concentration than exchanges, it itself becomes disulfide bonded and gives up its hydrogens. It reduces the disulfide bond that's been formed by oxidation earlier, the folding of the protein, so that the protein no longer has disulfides, no longer has cysteine in it, but two cystatines. So by a combination of SDS and treatment with mercaptoethanol, and usually for good measure, you boil the thing. So you want it denatured. You want all proteins to be going as random coils. So you can put a number on the molecular weight of the protein. No, the protein, if it's a single molecular weight, a single subunit protein, if it's a single, it's a monomeric protein with no quaternary structure, you have the molecular weight. But if, like hemoglobin, for instance, it has a quaternary structure, then what you're measuring is the subunit molecular weight, the molecular weight of the subunits by SDS, gel electrophoresis. So what's nice about it is pretty good resolution power. This is actually a little fuzzy. The bands can be even sharper than this. So you can resolve maybe 100 or more bands in a gel that's about, about 6-7 inches long. Here on the end, you can see you can buy from Sigma Chemical Company proteins of known molecular weight, run them alongside, so you can calibrate this gel. Say, well, if it went this far, it must be a little bit higher than this. You can, draw a graph and get some estimate of the molecular weight. Sometimes, if you don't know what your protein does, you might just say protein with a molecular weight of 53,000. Right? So we know it's in the thousands, so we just say P53. Right? And I use P53 as an example. Here the mark is 12,000, 18,000, 48. So somewhere between 48 and 80. And if you plot it out, you can put it on this nice curve that you can draw, a line you can draw. It's sort of a logarithm of the mobility. It's proportional to the molecular weight. And you can say 53,000. Now it might really be because some proteins bind SDS a little bit better than others. It's only an estimate. But it's pretty good. Could be 51, could be 56. So you name it P53, you don't know what it does. This became molecule of the year some 15 years ago or 20 years ago, about 15 years ago. Made the cover of Science because it's a protein whose gene for that protein is mutated in the majority of human cancers. So now a lot more is known about it. But you'll see quite a few proteins in the literature. It's called P27, P100, P53. Let's turn now to our third method. That was two forms of electrophoresis was the second. And this has several names. Molecular sieve chromatography, so you're filtering molecules on the basis, again, of their size and to some extent their shape. It has synonymous names like gel filtration. So you have little beads. In this case, it's not a slab gel, but it's little gel beads. Or Cefadex chromatography. These are little polysaccharide beads that have a brand name like Kleenex or Cefadex. If we look at one bead, we see they're constructed by the manufacturer in a very precise way. I don't know how they do it, but they make these little beads riddled with channels. Some of the channels may go all the way through. None of them here do, but most of them do not. They're just channels that are little dead ends. And the width of these channels is pretty highly controlled. So you can buy beads that have wide channels, beads that have medium-sized channels, beads that have very narrow channels. And they have numbers on them, and you buy what's good for you. All right. That's a Cefadex bead. Now you can imagine you have a whole, you pack these in a whole column, you have something on the bottom to hold it, a little screen, and you put your proteins on the top, and they're going to run. Now, it's a race to the bottom. So, and proteins are going to separate. So now we have big green proteins and little pink proteins, and they're approaching bead number one of, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of beads. They're a small column or a large column. As they go down, as they approach the beads, the little guys are bouncing around randomly. As they dance around, they necessarily can fit into these narrow channels. And so they go in here, which in terms of the object of getting to the bottom of the column is silly, because they're going to waste their time in these dead-end channels. The big guys can't get in, and they're better off for it. So they go right around the bead. So by the time they're down at the bottom of the bead, you've enriched. Of course, not all of these little guys will. This is a random process, so some of them by chance will never have entered one of these dallying channels here. And so you'll have a mixture, but now it's enriched for the green ones compared to the pink ones. And what happens now is you just meet another bead. So again, the pink ones are going to waste time, and the green ones are going to ignore the bead. So by the time you get to the bottom, the green ones win. And the pink ones will eventually come out, because you keep adding buffer to the top of the column gradually, just drop by drop, and collect it at the bottom, drop by drop, and move a series of tubes underneath. So we have fraction one and fraction two, collect a certain amount, 100 fractions. And you'll have the first, after a while, the green ones come out, and then like nothing, and then the pink ones come out. Now you can imagine you could have other colored ones that are light green ones that are just a little bit smaller than the let's say red ones that are just a little bit larger or smaller than the beads I showed. It doesn't have to be an all or none. You have some molecules make their way in, they have a little trouble, so they're held up a little bit compared to something that can't enter at all. And so you can say, so you have a continuous gradient. You can separate with a given size of beads, you have a certain range of molecular weights that you can separate and resolve one from the other. The resolution is not nearly as good as gel electrophoresis, but it has the advantage, this method, is that the proteins can be perfectly happy. You can do it in the cold room, right? And so the proteins will tend to not denature. And you can do it rather simple apparatus. This is just a plain glass tube, or you can get fancy ones where you introduce the material through pumps and tubing and collect it at the bottom. So what you get out is the information. Not only do you purify your protein, I mean, you won't purify it away from other proteins that have close to the same molecular weight, but it's one step. Generally, the purification of protein takes 5 or 6 steps, unless you get very fancy, indeed. But by traditional methods, like electrophoresis, and many I'm not talking about, there's a lot that I don't talk about, it's called column chromatography, which could be ion exchange chromatography or chromatography based on solubility. You can keep enriching, and if you get a tenfold purification, that's already good in one step. And you get 2 steps like that, you have 100-fold purification. And the next one is, you know, 3-fold purification. It's still worth it, right, to do it. So you get the information, besides the protein, you get the information of the native molecular weight, as opposed to the SDS gel electrophoresis, which gave you the subunit molecular weight. And armed with those 2 numbers, you can already draw a conclusion about the quaternary structure of your protein. If its molecular weight, according to Cepheid-X chromatography, is 64,000, and on SDS, you see your protein is, SDS electrophoresis, your protein is 16,000, then you know it's a tetramer, right? So there's plenty of problems now. I should point out that we have an exam coming up, our first exam. We have lots of exams, so the first one is coming up on a week from today. And we'll cover whatever I get to in this lecture. And tonight I'll make an exam page with all this sort of information on it. The organization of the exams in such a large class is rather operatic. And there'll be many rooms, and there'll be 2 different times. One time is around 5:40, 5:35 or 5:40. And another time is at 7:30, and you have 100 minutes. So keep your eyes open for your room assignments. Every student will be assigned to a room. You must go to the room to which you've been assigned. Otherwise, we get too crowded. So keep your eyes open for that. If you have any questions about your assignment to a particular room, or you have some conflict about the time, email Jesse. Now, there's plenty of problems. We started out, there weren't that many problems to do in lectures 1 and 2. Now they're coming hot and heavy, and the exam's in 1 week. If you haven't been doing the problems, which is a mistake, now in 2, we're going to get probably through 2 and most of set 3 and 3R. So you might have more problems than you can do. And it's good to be able to do all the problems. I'm saying not necessary, but in terms of preparation for the exam. So if you have been going slow on the problems, now's the time to step it up. And you can't possibly wait until even the weekend. What about shape in SDS selective freezes? Is that a factor? Well, you can imagine that whereas a sphere has trouble getting in, if you have some kind of cigar-shaped molecule, maybe it could get in. But I'll make the same argument I made for centrifugation, that the cigar-shaped molecule, or an elongated molecule spearing its way in here into the one of the channels of a gel filtration bead, I'm trying to call it by its various names, is that it's not usually in this orientation, but usually in one of the other orientations, a composite of all the orientations, or many of the orientations it could have. And you can see if it went in sideways, it would have even more trouble than the spherical guy of the same molecular weight. So again, the sphere is the one that of all the shapes, the sphere is the one that can get into these channels most easily, and therefore will be held up. And so that if you have a non-spherical molecule, it will travel faster than you would think from its molecular weight if you assume they're all spherical. Most of the molecules are spherical, but there's a lot that are not. So sometimes you can get away with assuming it's spherical, and usually have to say, if it's spherical, then the molecular weight is such and such. How do you know what the molecular weight is? Again, you have your column, it's set up, it runs the same every time, so you put in the standards you bought from Sigma Chemical Company, you watch the proteins of no molecular weight come out, and they're all spherical. And then you make a note of the time, you draw a graph, this came out, or after how much volume of liquid came out, and then you run the column again with your sample, and you depend on it being reproducible, which it is. Okay, this is just a summary of it, which you have a handout for this, and a lot of more words about it, so I'm not going to take time in the lecture to do this, because we're running behind. Now let's turn to, we're done now with our methodology section. The methodology allows us to write lots of problems using mercaptan ethanol, SDS, native gel, this, that. Again, so that you get very familiar with the subjects of this of these separations, the proteins themselves, in part. So although we didn't talk a lot about it in lecture in terms of time, the problems are sort of disproportionately use that information, and you have that handout. So, as I say, the rationale is that we're talking about protein structure, which we have spent a lot of time on, by using these problems so that you really test your understanding of it. So let's talk about this class of proteins that are enzymes and that are very important for giving us our characteristics of life. Enzymes are protein catalysts. So what's a catalyst? Catalyst speeds up a reaction. If we look back at our logo, which we haven't seen for a while, and now we go in and look at what's happening inside this cell in terms of synthesis of all these monomers and other small molecules, if I'm then going to go into the macromolecules, there we saw before there were a bunch of arrows and leading to the various intermediates and finally to the monomers. And then more arrows going on. Each arrow is a specific chemical reaction, right, that takes, you know, blue to purple here, or orange to red. And each of those reactions has to be catalyzed by an enzyme, which is a protein. So this is a major class of the functional proteins of the cell, are the enzymes that speed up these reactions which have to occur so that they happen in a time consistent with E. coli in minimal medium doubling in 1 hour, or our skin cell in its growth medium doubling in 24 hours. Each arrow is an enzyme, and we have thousands of arrows and thousands of enzymes in E. coli. And same for us. So we're going to talk about speeding up a reaction. Let's talk about first just chemical reactions in general and see how their reaction rate is controlled. Let's take just an inorganic kind of reaction. Hydrogen, H2 is the molecular form of hydrogen, and iodine, I2. So these hydrogen molecules can exist in hydrogen gas like this, bonded to each other, iodine bonded to each other. Or you can imagine these atoms in a different configuration, one with the other, so that hydrogen and iodine are bound together. Now, you can draw a reaction so that these atoms are rearranged, and that is a chemical reaction, so you have new kinds of covalent bonds being formed. And you can draw an arrow left to right, if that's the way we're talking about it, we choose it. And then there's an energy consideration that's involved with these two forms of these chemicals, right? If we draw an arrow like this, and if the reaction is going to tend to go from left to right, we don't know which way it's going to go, say, to start with, but I tell you that when I go from left to right, energy is released. If energy is released, that's the direction the reaction will tend to go. In reality, all of these reactions are reversible. So we're talking about which way net it would go. If we start with H2 and I2, will we end up with more hydrogen iodide, or will we end up with more of the same product? So since energy is released, the reaction is the energy is defined this way, it goes to the right. And what it means is that the HI molecules are more stable than the HH or the II molecules here. And one way to think about this is that if the HI bond is stronger, it's going to take, and you want to rearrange them, you're going to have to break open this HI bond, say, to go backwards. And if it takes more energy to do that, it's going to be less likely than breaking the HH or the II bonds. And that's why the reaction will go to the right. We can look at this a little more in a little more detail. If we think of the reaction this way. This is kind of an energy diagram, which we'll use several times here today. And on the y-axis here, we have the change in energy associated with this kind of chemical transformation. So I said energy was released, and that is defined as a negative energy change. So if you have an energy change of, here, say, -3 kilocalories per mole, that means on this scale, the 2HI is lower. So when you go from H2 plus I2 to 2HI, you go down and lose three kilocalories of energy, and the reaction will tend to go to the right. So what is the mechanism by which this transformation could take place? If you just consider these two gases, I think iodine is also a gas. Not sure. Well, one way, simple way to think about it is, let's take the atoms apart and then put them back together and let them choose their mates randomly, right? So if we take H2 and I2 apart so that now we have the separate atoms, this is not the way it occurs, but it's a thought experiment, right? We said covalent bonds are in the range of 100 kilocalories per mole, let's say. So we take 100 kilocalories per mole, let's say, for H2 and I2, those bonds to be broken, and so that we get the atoms. And then they could go back, there's an arrowhead down here, and reform, and you have to put in 100 kilocalories per mole of energy to get them apart, and then you'd release 100 kilocalories per mole for them to snap back together. But they could snap back together in this other way to make HI, and in fact they would go down further. Now, if you wanted to pull the HI apart, if this were exactly 100, then this would be, since I told you it's a 3 kilocalories per mole difference, this would be 103 kilocalories per mole to take the HIs apart, right? So now maybe you get a feel for why the reaction is going to the right, and why we say the HI is more stable, and that reactions will run towards a more stable configuration of their atoms. Because it's just harder to go back. You're always going back and forth, but it's harder to go back because these are stronger bonds. So So the word spontaneously is used advisedly here. It means something in chemistry. It means it's going to the right as written. And then we have fancier words, like if a reaction goes spontaneously to the right, it's called exergonic. Because if it doesn't go spontaneously to the right, what are we going to call it? Non-spontaneous, right? We call it endergonic, right? Let's look at the next line. So if it goes to the right and releases energy, exergonic. And if it has to absorb energy when the reaction occurs, it's endergonic. These are just terms, right, that are useful for us. You can write these reactions in various ways. Sometimes, sometimes these arrows are sort of abbreviations and don't necessarily mean, if you draw an arrow here at the top left to right, doesn't mean the reaction doesn't go backwards. If you want to be a little more rigorous, you might put arrowheads on both sides. Or you might say it can go either way by drawing two arrows, right? Forward and reverse. And you might draw them the same. Even then, you're just, depending on the context of what you're saying, it doesn't necessarily mean they go at the same rate or with the same energy release. You might want to give that information by showing the long arrow in one direction and a short arrow in this direction, which is true for this reaction because it tends to go to the right. Or you might give it a big fat arrow to the right. So you'll see all those different configurations when you read your text. Now, in reality, reactions don't occur by pulling the atoms apart entirely. That would be very hard to do. But rather, they go through an intermediate stage. And think of it this way. You're starting with H2 and I2, and you want to rearrange the atoms. Now, these molecules are dancing around in space, and in order to react with each other then, they're able to react with each other by colliding with each other and not necessarily having them separated into individual atoms. So if they're going around and they bounce into one another at some speed, at some velocity, nothing much happens. Their bonds are between their own atoms are too strong to withstand a collision like that. But if the collision is fast enough, they will form an intermediate state where they're not sure where they came from because they collided with such efficiency, with such force. Right. This is called the transition state, TS, transition state. And I draw bonds around all the atoms very temporarily. And now they're going to sort this out in the next microsecond. And when they sort it out, they could break apart here through with the top guys going together and the bottom guys going together, and in which case nothing has happened. They started out with H2 and I2. But if they separate here with the left guys going together and the right guys going together, then we have our product. So we mix these together. Those few molecules that collide with sufficient velocity have the possibility then of making a product. And then we got the same thing. These HIs can collide with each other and have the reverse reaction. But they would have to collide at a higher velocity, right? Because they are stronger to reach that transition state. So we can insert this transition state into our energy diagram, which is like way less than the energy necessary to pull apart the atoms. And we're going to forget about this thought experiment and talk about transition states from now on. This is what's going to be on top, this transition state. So you put in an amount of energy necessary to reach the transition state, and then you can fall down this way, or you can actually fall down back to your products. But you have to have enough energy to reach that transition state. That energy is called the activation energy. Say it's much less. The chances of these things happening go as this energy in the exponent. So a difference of 5 is a lot. So let's talk about the activation energy then. So I'm going to put the transition state now on top, and we'll talk about the whole distance here of the activation energy. Now, I want to make it clear there are two separate concepts here. One is the activation energy, and then there's this, don't forget this, 3 kilocalories per mole down here. The 3 kilocalories per mole, regardless of how you got there, just comparing your reactants to your products. If 3 kilocalories, this should be minus 3 kilocalories per mole, or importantly. The activation energy is the energy you need that allows the reaction to happen, that allows these molecules to interact, allows the transition state to be formed. And that determines how fast the reaction will take place. How many molecules have sufficient velocity to collide with and achieve the activation energy. But this difference down here tells you, regardless of how you get there, what is the net energy change, which direction will the reaction go? So we have two problems here, and we can see how the cell has to deal with these two problems. We're first going to talk about how the cell, we'll take it for granted the direction is favorable, let's say, and we want to know how we can speed up the reaction so that it can take place in a time scale consistent with life. So we have these two separate concepts: speed or velocity and direction. I just said that. We're going to, over the next two lectures, deal with these two problems. Today it's direction, it's speed, it's the velocity, right? This just tells you that although we're putting off direction, it's something we have to worry about. So for instance, if we wanted to make fatty acids, to make phospholipid or fat, whatever, and we're going to use 3 6-carbon glucose molecules to do that, to make this 18-carbon fatty acid, what's the free energy change associated with that? It's 300 kilocalories per mole in the wrong direction. So the directionality is not at all assured. We draw it like that. And we'll talk about that next time. Now we're going to talk about catalysis. We're going to keep our same hydrogen and iodine, and instead of having them find each other at random and then happen to have two that collide with sufficient velocity to enable a transition state to be reached, which is like this rare event. It's only a tiny fraction of the molecules, let's say, at room temperature. Only a tiny fraction of the molecules. So temperature is telling you how fast they go. They're not all going the same speed. Some are going like this, and some are going like this. And you have a distribution of speeds. So it's only if you have this sort of bell-shaped curve, and way on the right you have the ones that are traveling the highest. Those are the only ones that have a chance of colliding. And they're a tiny fraction of the total. Right. So what catalysts do is they take that tiny fraction and make it a lot bigger by bringing all the reactants together in the same place. They don't have to find each other. They provide a surface. In this case, for this reaction, platinum. So it's not a big bar of platinum. We want a surface. So we grind it up into very fine powder. You put in powdered platinum, as you find powdered platinum in your car exhaust systems, clean up the pollutants in your exhaust. Platinum will bind hydrogen and iodine on its surface. And so sometimes two hydrogens get together, and they could even maybe exchange their bonds, but you never know because they just come out the same thing. Or a hydrogen and an iodine might bind pretty close together, but not quite close enough together to form, it's starting to look like a transition state complex. But if they can really cuddle up on here on the surface, we've got a lot of cuddling in this class, a lot of cuddling, they cuddle up and they're so close that they're essentially forming a transition state complex right on the surface of the platinum. Yes? Okay. So, and we have tremendous amount of this surface. So all this gas gloms onto the surface, finds a partner, and you get your product. It doesn't take that much activation energy to get together and just bind the platinum. So instead of this business of colliding and having to go all the way up here to this 20, we now have, in the presence of a catalyst, a much lower activation energy. The platinum just sitting there, it doesn't, yes, it's bonding to the hydrogen and iodide, and indeed, by its bonding, it's maybe weakening the bond between the two atoms in hydrogen gas and in the iodine. So it can act then in two ways. One, by positioning, that's the main way, by positioning the reactants so they're right next to each other, Much as, you know, the closure of the glucose ring. Those guys were positioned by the fact of being tethered to each other. So it's the same kind of principle, except here we have a third party doing it. It's not inside. There's an intermolecular reaction. So catalysts act by reducing the activation energy, essentially by binding the reactants to a common surface. Enzymes work this way. What the enzymes add is great specificity. I told you already that ligands are small molecules that bind to a large molecule like a protein, and that's the word that's used. But once we have this protein being an enzyme and it's going to do something with these bound small molecules, we use the word substrate. It's the substrate for an enzymatic reaction. These are the reactants. Substrates and products. And in general, what's happening is you have, let's say, in this case, we're going to condense two molecules together, and we have lots of candidates for fitting into this pocket, which is now, in the case of an enzyme, called the active site. So the active site is where all the activity is taking place, where the protein, where the substrates bind, and where the reaction is realized. Right? So that's the whole business here. If the direction is indeed favorable, you'll get the product, which is then released. There is some confusion. I tend to make a distinction. In the books, often they're used synonymously, but it seems to me logical that the active site is not necessarily the same as the substrate binding site, because you might need some activity, say, out here at the edges, to facilitate the reaction, some side chain of the amino acid that's extracting a proton, but isn't involved in the actual binding. It's more in the catalysis itself. So by the active site, I'm talking about the whole business, and the substrate binding site could be the same, but it could be just a large part, but not the whole active site, just the part that binds the substrate. I find it useful to be able to distinguish those. I hope we'll get to. Here's a space-filling model, again, that shows the binding of a substrate, and these blue balls are the side chains of the amino acids that are playing a role in that binding. So, because of this stringent requirement for fitting in order to cuddle up, that the enzymes are much more specific than an inorganic catalyst like platinum. Platinum will speed up that reaction between hydrogen and iodine may be 10,000 fold, right? It will go 10,000 times faster in the presence of platinum. But it's indiscriminate. Platinum will bind a whole bunch of stuff. Platinum will bind double bonded compounds. Platinum will bond unsaturated fatty acids, right? And it will bond hydrogen. So if you wanted to hydrogenate that double bond, hydrogenated canola oil, right? That's what you use, platinum and hydrogen gas. And then it adds across that double bond. And it will take, you know, any fatty acid, no matter how long or how short. Whereas enzymes are very particular. If you remember our picture of our specificity for protein binding, this is what's coming into play now for enzymes. If you have an enzyme that's going to, say, take the amino group off of alanine, split it off, which there are such enzymes, right, or transfer it to something else, it'll accept alanine, but it won't bind glycine well enough for this reaction. So you can have a specific alanine transaminase that doesn't work on glycine, say. Let's take this a specific example. So we're going to start to see that names of different enzymes, and names very often are useful. So this is called succinic dehydrogenase, and it's a reversible reaction. And what's succinate here? What do we have here, for example? Is this complicated? Not that complicated. What would we call this? This is a 4-carbon dicarboxylic acid. So this I expect you to know. If I say it's a 4-carbon dicarboxylic acid, you're supposed to know what the carboxyl is from your sheet of functional groups. I say 4 carbons, you know many carbons. And if they say di, you don't necessarily know it's in a linear arrangement like this. I'll grant you that. But you should have some idea what it looks like. This one's called succinic acid. I don't expect you to know that. So succinic acid, if it's dehydrogenated, which is going from right to left, you get a double bond here, and you get a different compound. It's called fumaric acid. So it's got the double bond. It's called fumaric acid. So this is an unsaturated 4-carbon dicarboxylic acid. So if we consider fumaric acid as a substrate for the reverse reaction of succinic dehydrogenase, which could be called fumarate hydrogenase, that would be reasonable, but it's not. In the cell, the important reaction is right to left. So if we have an OH here instead of a COOH, it's rejected by succinic dehydrogenase. It will not add 2 hydrogens to that double bond with that change. So it's very unlike platinum in that respect. Even if we have something like maleic acid, so we say fumaric acid, we see a double bond. Nobody told you whether it's cis or trans, but I'll tell you now, fumarate is trans. We could say transfumarate to make it more explicit, so that the two different groups are the two carboxyls are on different sides of this C double bond C, and you can imagine a structural isomer or a stereoisomer around double bonds, which is the cis form, and that's actually given a different name, maleate or maleic acid. Right. So maleic acid is rejected by this enzyme. So just as when I held that 4-carbon model of the amino acid with a green ball in one hand and a brown ball in the other, and the orange was sticking out, so the enzyme is looking for something like this. And if the carboxyl's in the wrong place, forget it. It's not to say we can't fool these enzymes, it will say. They're not perfect in their specificity. Okay. So, to summarize our preview of enzymes, or our overall view of enzymes. They bind substrates by putting them together, and they actually can participate in the reaction by weakening the bonds that hold they can facilitate the actual reaction that puts these together by influencing the bonds that are in play for the two reactants. And And the catalyst itself, just like that platinum, take it out of this environment, you wash it, nothing's changed about the platinum. The enzyme, by definition, a catalyst, participates in the reaction, but in the end comes out the same. It has no net change in the enzyme. It could even form a covalent bond for a few seconds, right, with the enzyme. In some cases that happens, and then it's broken as part of the reaction process, a little more complicated. But in the end, the enzyme, being a catalyst, comes back to what it was in the beginning, but your products are different from your reactants. Here's a movie I found, one of my favorite enzymes I've worked on in the past, not so much on the protein, but on the gene. And this is a movie. Let's see if that works. Oh, it's crashed the whole thing. Oh, that was bad. Let's see. If I click on it. Nope. It worked in PowerPoint 2003, and not in 2007. Anyway, the point here was that the enzyme is not just this block, mold, concrete form. It is this dynamic, squishy thing. And it, when it reacts with the substrate can fit in there, but the enzyme can accommodate it. It could open up a little, and it could curl around and hold that substrate in, all via these weak interactions. What this movie is supposed to show, and you can get it here, that's all one line, right? At this website, and it's even I think it's a full MPG, it's like a little movie, is that one substrate here in green is bound, another substrate is going to fly in here. These loops of non-secondary structure of the protein are going to open up, close up, reaction takes place, they open up, let the product out, and another substrate comes in, they close up and make a little compartment almost inside where, in this case, hydrogen atoms are being transferred, dihydrofolate reductase, it reduces dihydrofolate to adds two more hydrogens, so it becomes tetrahydrofolate, so that it's an active vitamin that can help you do reactions. Okay, let's treat this whole business a lot more quantitatively about the speed of these reactions. So our reaction is substrate is going to product, and we're going to abbreviate these S for substrate and P for product. And we can start talking about the rate of these reactions, which we've been talking about now only qualitatively, right? Semi-quantitatively. So we can define velocity of the reaction. V is equal to the change in product per unit time, or delta P over delta T, or dP dT, if you wish. Right? Similarly, that same velocity can be expressed as the disappearance of the substrate. So that's pretty straightforward and trivial. Less trivial now, from the laws of mass action, that the rate of the reaction, whether it's expressed as product appearing or substrate disappearing, is governed by a rate constant, which is just related to how much activation energy, basically, you need. And so that's particular for the reactants that you're talking about. And it's going to be driven by the concentration of the substrate you have, right? So if you have a high concentration of substrate, the chance of them colliding to give you this is just without catalyst or anything, the chance of them getting colliding is going to be just that much greater, right? So the substrate molecules, say, have to combine in this case to make a product, you can think of it, and so the chance of collision is just proportional to the substrate concentration. But since we know everything is reversible, as the product is made, we have to consider that the net formation of products is going to slow down because you're going to be losing product by this minus another rate constant times the amount of product you have going backwards. So that's a way of talking about the velocity of the reaction in terms of substrate and product concentrations. However, we can simplify this whole problem. This back reaction really complicates things mathematically. So we can simplify this whole thing and just talk about the initial reaction. So we start just with S, and there's no P. And we say, what is the relationship between the rate of the reaction and the concentration of S, the concentration of our substrate per unit time? And we just look at the beginning of the reaction, so there's not enough P to very much influence this number. This we call the initial velocity. And it's the only velocity we're going to be talking about, because otherwise it's too complicated. So we'll be talking about initial velocity, and that's indicated by V-naught. Sometimes we'll forget to put the naught in, but naught's always there in our discussions. So V-naught is then this simple thing, which is just, it's dependent on the substrate concentration. It's called a first-order reaction. So we can graphically see this, that the product... that the product goes up linearly with time, and we could say measure the amount of product at various times. This could be the result of an experiment, and we get a slope. So that slope is going to be the dP dT, and our velocity. The slope is V naught in this case. Now we can, if we want to ask how it varies with the amount of substrate, we can run the reaction at one substrate concentration, say S1, and we get a certain velocity, a certain slope. And we call that S1. Now we do then we do a separate experiment, and we start with S2 instead of S1, and S2 is twice as much. Well, we're going to get a slope of P versus T that is twice as much. And now we make it three times as much. And we see another slope, etc. So we're not going to see too many of these P versus T's. I may have to resort to a pencil. I put them in backwards. I did. So we could take each of these slopes and plot it as a function of the substrate concentration. That is a V naught versus S. That's mostly what we're going to be talking about. So there's just a reproduction of what we had on the last slide. And so that each of these slopes becomes a point now, S1, S2, etc. And we have a V0 on the y-axis instead of P. So there's already dP dt on the y-axis. And again, we get this straight line because we have this relationship. K1 is just proportional. The more substrate we go in, the more chance they'll collide, the faster the reaction goes. Very straightforward. That's chemical kinetics for simple reactions. What about an enzyme now? We add a catalyst, the enzyme. First of all, if we go back to our P versus T, we see that in the absence of the enzyme, we have this very slow rate, and we add the enzyme, and it's much faster. And indeed, this is exaggerated here, because if platinum can improve the speed of reaction 10,000 fold, well, so can enzymes. So this could be 1/10,000th of this slope, this low slope, and so we can ignore it. So we talk about enzyme-catalyzed reactions, we don't have to talk about the reaction in the absence of the enzyme. Now let's go to our V0 versus S curve for an enzyme reaction. And what we see is that in the beginning, it's pretty much like the chemical reaction, right? Linear, right? But then as we go to higher and higher substrate concentration, it deviates from that linearity and gives us this smooth curve. So what's going on here? This is now enzyme kinetics, enzyme-catalyzed reaction, relationship of velocity as a function of the substrate concentration. Well, as you can see, these two different phases of this curve and the transition in between. So, how can we understand what's going on here? This was explained about 100 years ago by Michaelis and Menten, who considered what is the mechanism what's going on here. You have an enzyme, and you have a substrate, and one fits in the other. They barely knew what proteins were these days. So this is quite an accomplishment, actually. Let's say, as part of this whole, makes this assumption, that the way enzymes work is they form a complex with a substrate. This is reasonable, and this is an assumption. So you form an enzyme-substrate complex, ES. And that already is a reaction, right? A binding reaction. And it goes forward with a constant K1, and we will use these numbers are not arbitrary. The K1 is the formation of the ES complex, and K2 is its disassociation. Then what happens? Well, then you get products formed and released. So we can put those two together, and we have K3, then is the product is released and the enzyme's back to where it was. And we have to consider, let's say, to start, the back reaction where the product could go with the enzyme and you get the substrate back, the reverse reaction, in theory. Right? But since we're only going to be talking... Oh, there's Michaelis and Menten. Right? But just like with the chemical kinetics, we're going to simplify things. We can say... That reaction 4 here is negligible because we're only going to consider the initial reaction starting with all substrate and not enough product has built up in order to drive this reverse reaction. So for initial velocity, we have no K4. Now we come to a little bit the insight. We're going to be deriving a formula to explain that curve. We're not going to be deriving it. I'm going to show you the outlines of it. On your handout, and not to be covered in lectures, it takes too much time, but it's really very satisfying. I think it would be rewarding to sit down for 10 minutes and look at this derivation, which is just straightforward algebra. But that derivation is going to depend very much on this assumption that the enzyme-substrate complex is in a steady state during this initial phase of the reaction, and its concentration is unchanged. So this was not obvious, right? That is, you have E and S goes together to ES, and then ES can either go back or it can go forward to E plus P. And very soon after the reaction starts, this ES is at a constant, unchanging concentration, being formed by K1 and being deformed by K2 and K3, and those two equal each other. I will harp on this a little more. Although there's no net change in the ES concentration, You might say, well, it's at equilibrium, and this would be wrong. It's not at equilibrium. Equilibrium means something very specific, and this is a distinction that even some of my colleagues tend to gloss over or make mistakes. Here's equilibrium. You have two tanks of water connected by a valve. One tank has a lot of water, the other tank has very little. You open the valve because of the pressure head on this water on the left, it's going to drop, and the one on the right is going to go up, and it's not going to go up much higher than this. The water molecules are going to be going back and forth through this valve, and you're going to have the same pressure on both sides, and so the system is at equilibrium. You can tell it's at equilibrium because it's at a constant level. There's no change. It's at equilibrium. And there's no net flow one way or the other. There's flow going on, water molecules diffusing back and forth, but there's no net flow from one tank to the other. System's at equilibrium. Now consider another situation where you have just a tank here so far, and you open the valve, but now you replace what's the water that starts to flow out through this valve with a source of more water. So the water, the source goes up. If it's at a low rate, the whole thing might drain. So you increase the rate of what's going on here, of what's going in here at the top, and you increase it, say, more and more. And as you increase it, you see that it will get to a point where it reaches a certain pressure head. And now, even though the water's coming in fast from the top, it's built up such a pressure head that it's spewing out the water at the bottom because of all this pressure at the same rate as it's coming in. And if you increase this rate, and I should have made it lower, say, to begin with. If you increase this rate, this pressure head, this amount of water would have to go higher in order to drive the water out at the same rate that is coming in. But it'll reach a state in which this pressure, this liquid at the top, this water, will not change. The system here is in steady state. We have a constant level of water in this tank. It's not, you measure it, it's not changing. Just like here, constant level. But unlike equilibrium, where there was no net flow, there is plenty of flow going on here. This is what life is like, as we'll see when we get to energy. Life is not at equilibrium. Life is in a steady state with a constant dynamic flow of materials going through us. And the same is true for our enzyme reaction. So here, this tank is the ES complex. It's at a constant level, even though we have enzyme and substrate coming in and product spewing out at the other end. Once you make that assumption, or you have the insight to see that's probably the way things are, and you apply it to the algebra and this derivation, you are able to get what's called the Michaelis-Menten equation. I guess Menten lost the coin toss, perhaps. And there's constants of, these are the same constants that are up here. So you have K3. E0 is the total amount of enzyme in the system, say number of moles or number of molecules. And S is the substrate concentration. So you see, we can simplify. This looks a little busy. So we simplify it one easy way with this busy term on the bottom, K2 plus K3 over K1. These are constants for a particular enzyme and a particular reaction. Right? So we can gather them together and just call them Km for the Michaelis constant. So that's called the Michaelis constant. That's where the coin toss was lost. So we have K3, E0, substrate concentration, divided by Km, just constant, plus substrate concentration. This is a very common situation in many biochemical situations, even besides enzymes. So what about this equation? Does it explain our curve? First of all, there's what was not on our curve, if you consider just a certain amount of enzyme, the rate is proportional to the amount of enzyme. And this is reasonable. The enzyme is usually present in a way smaller amount than any of the substrates or products. So you double the amount of enzyme, you double the rate of the reaction. Increase the amount of enzyme 15-fold, the initial velocity would be just 15 times higher. The catalyst is limiting. In most of these situations. Other than this, for a given amount of enzyme, they're all constants except for substrate. Now let's think back to that V0 versus S. We see Over on the left, when substrate concentration is low, what happens? At low substrate, well, what's low? Let's say low compared to Km here, which is being added to. So S is much less than Km, then we can forget S, and we can approximate this by K3 E naught S over Km, which just says that the initial velocity is just proportional to the substrate concentration for a given amount of enzyme, and that's what we saw. Right? It was sort of linear at the beginning. How about high S at the other end? At the other end, way out here, you have high S. High compared to what? Again, compared to Km, which is being added to. So now we have, forget Km compared to S, and these two S's cancel out, and we just see that V naught is just equal to K3 E naught. It doesn't depend on S at all at high S. It's just independent of it. So it seems like, actually, it explains it very well. So here's our high S. And we can talk about this high S value, this K3 E naught, as the maximum velocity, initial velocity, the maximum initial velocity that the enzyme can, given amount of enzyme can achieve with respect to substrate concentration. It just levels out. And you can think of it conceptually. The enzyme just saturated with substrate. It's binding the substrate as fast as it possibly can. It doesn't matter if you increase the substrate concentration 100-fold. It's already binding it as fast as it can. Well, the same is not true down here. Down at the left side of the curve, the substrate concentration is participating in determining the velocity of the reaction. So now we have a simpler form of, we can write a simpler form of the Michaelis-Menten equation, which is already looking like this, because this maximum velocity we see is just K3 E naught. The amount of enzyme times that one rate constant K3. We define that as V max, and so we can write the simplest form of the Michaelis-Menten equation as V naught equals V max S divided by Km plus S. Don't have to memorize these equations. But it, built into this Vmax is the fact that this K3E0, the Vmax only makes sense for a given amount of enzyme. So it's an operational definition. If you put a certain amount of enzyme in, then you'll have a certain amount of Vmax. Let's talk more about this Vmax. It's the maximum initial velocity achievable for this amount of enzyme. And it's equal to K3E0. So let's rearrange that equation. And we get an idea what K3 is. K3 is the maximum velocity that this amount of enzyme can make. What's velocity? Number of moles of product produced per second, right? Divided by the number of moles of enzyme that you have present. Number of molecules of product being produced per second divided by the number of molecules of enzyme you have to catalyze that reaction. So that K3 is telling us something about how good this enzyme is. How fast? How good is its catalytic power? We put a number on it. That number, K3 then, is called the turnover number. How fast can you, substrate concentration, not a question. You're putting in plenty of substrate. Given that you're saturated with substrate, how fast can you actually facilitate this reaction? So it's a measure of the catalytic power of the, how fast it can turn over a substrate into product. And what kind of numbers do we have for this? How about that succinic dehydrogenase? I looked it up. You can look up these numbers in a book. Right? It's about 19. This is in turnover numbers usually per second. So it's 19 per second, second minus 1. So that's below average for most enzymes. Most enzymes are in this range, about 100 to 1,000, at least the ones I've seen. So 100, even 1,000 molecules of substrate turned into product per second for one molecule of enzyme. So that sounds pretty fast. What's the winner? This simple reaction called the soda reaction. Carbon dioxide and water can get together and form carbonic acid. So It's important to do that somewhere in some cells of our body, so we have an enzyme for it called carbonic anhydrase. It's named for the, the reverse reaction, taking away water. What's the turnover number for that? 600,000. 600,000 molecules of carbonic acid for one molecule of carbonic anhydrase per second. So it can be very fast, very efficient. What about this KM? Does it have any special significance? You bet it does. Let's consider numerically. We already know what is KM. It's K2 plus K3 over K1. It was defined that way. But it also has certain properties. For example, if you consider the initial velocity, that's one half of the maximum velocity over here. And you look down here and you ask, what is that substrate concentration? So effectively, you're asking, what is the substrate concentration that will drive this reaction to one half of its maximum velocity? And what's that going to depend on? That depends on kind of the shape of this approach to maximum, the shape of this curve, right? So if it's very shallow, you know, you might have to go all the way out here in order to get one half that maximum. So for this curve, it's right here, roughly. If you ask that from the Michaelis-Menten equation and say, what is V naught? Set V naught equal to V max over 2 and plug in all the values and solve for S. S comes out to be equal to Km. So numerically, Km is equal to the substrate concentration and has units of concentration, like moles per liter. Right? It's the substrate concentration that drives the reaction to one half its maximum velocity. So maybe that's cute. Does it give us any kind of insight into how the enzyme works? We already have the turnover number, but we don't have anything to describe sort of the shape. We don't have anything to describe how the enzyme is interacting with its substrate. So now let's consider further this this KM business. And let's just talk about this part of the Michaelis-Menten mechanism, right? The association of the enzyme and the substrate to form enzyme-substrate complex. And as you'll see, it's useful for us to consider the back reaction, consider the reverse reaction, the dissociation reaction. I'll write it now over here just symbolically. ES goes, keeping the same numbers here, K2 is the dissociation, right? It's the lower arrow up here, and now it's the upper arrow. So talking, putting the right-facing arrow to on top. ES with K2 goes to E plus S, and with K1 goes back to ES. Right. So this is describing the dissociation of the substrate from the enzyme. We can consider the equilibrium constant for this reaction, just like we can consider the equilibrium constant for any reaction. So we know the equilibrium constant for this dissociation, which we'll call KD, right, is just at equilibrium, the concentration of the two dissociated guys, the guys on the right here, E plus S, their concentrations multiplied by each other, divided by the concentration of the starting compound. So that's, from your chemistry, that's the equilibrium constant. Now, what you may not have had in your chemistry is if you have a reaction like this, that you can write the KD as the as these concentrations, but it's also always going to be equal to the rate constant for the forward reaction divided by the rate constant for the reverse reaction. In the notes, lecture notes, I think this is simply derived from first principles, although it's not obvious, right? Maybe to you, but it's true. I won't take the time for it. So the dissociation constant can be described either this way in terms of concentrations, or it can be described as the forward reaction rate divided by the reverse reaction rate. That gives you the rate constant. But now we have K2 over K1. K2 over K1. And what was Km again? Km again was K2 plus K3 over K1. So if we could just imagine that K3 is small compared to K2. What is K3 here? K3 is the dissociation to product. So maybe that's slower, right? Because you have to break the bonds and make something. This is not a great assumption, but it's a useful assumption. In many cases, K3 is much slower than K2. So in that case, we can approximate the Km in this case, if K3 is much less than K2. The Km is approximately equal to K2 over K1, which is just the equilibrium constant for the dissociation reaction we just decided. Right. So with this way of estimating, looking at Km a little bit loosely, it's related to the equilibrium constant for K2 over K1, the dissociation of the enzyme substrate complex. So the smaller the Km, Km is units of concentration, let's say. If it's 10 to the minus 3, let's say, that means it's dissociating with that with that equilibrium constant. It tends to be held. The smaller that dissociation constant, the more tightly it must be that the substrate's being held. So a small Km, let's say it's 10 to the minus 6, right? That would be a much tighter binding. It's letting go with much to a much less extent with a K2 over K1 of 10 to the minus 6, and maybe a Km of about 10 to the minus 6. So Km is an indicator of the tightness with which the enzyme can bind the substrate, or how well the enzyme can bind the substrate, and numerically, it's inversely related to it. So the smaller the Km, the tighter the enzyme binds. And the greater the Km, the poorer the enzyme binds. So the Km is telling us something about the binding of the enzyme with its substrate. Again, here, 10 to the minus 6 is pretty good. 10 to the minus 3 is fairly poor. And you have everything in between. And that's the range for most. You find some outside this range. So between Km and K3, which is, remember, the turnover number, and the Km, we have a quantitative indication of how these enzymes work. You can have an enzyme that just grabs that substrate, even at low concentrations, maybe necessary, maybe not much substrate, so it's got to bind it tightly, and then takes its sweet time with the catalytic, has a lousy turnover number. Or you have plenty of substrate, you don't need such a great Km, plenty of glucose, say, in your diet. And then you want to turn over at a fast rate. Or you could have enzymes that are good at both or bad at both. So we'll continue with enzymes next time for a little while, talking about how we can modulate their activity within inhibitors.